Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by moi, Kenneth Doust. In this installment, number 158, we ask, who are the real pirates? And who are the real psycho killers? Plus our first ever book report. I hope you'll stay tuned. Earlier this year, there was a well-publicized mafia bust here in the Northeast, and the Somali pirates were acting up again. So we did a show that asked the rather obvious question, who are the real gangsters? Well, maybe the question wasn't obvious, but the answer was, ask yourself, who has done more harm to America and stolen more of your money? La Cosa Nostra's Vinny the Chin Gigante, or Lloyd Mr. Blankfein, Blankfein of the Goldman Sachs mob? To say nothing of his fellow highwaymen in the U.S. Treasury and the Federal Reserve. Alas, we didn't have time to get to the Somali pirates versus the real Somali pirates, so we'll take that issue up today. And we'll ask, who are the real psycho killers, mass murderers? On the one hand, Charles Manson, the son of Sam, Jared Luffner, and James Huberty, the guy who shot up at McDonald's in San Diego. On the other hand, Bush and Obama, the top brass at the Pentagon and State Department, and our client strongmen like Pinochet, Saddam Hussein, Mubarak, and Soleimani, all of whom together couldn't match the United States' former best buddy, Stalin, when it comes to mass murder. As with Who Are the Real Gangsters?, the fun is not in the answer itself. The fun is in the details that support the answer. So let's start having fun. Speaking of pirates, the Somali pirates were also back in the news. At the same time the cops were busting up the mafia, half the Navy of South Korea, assisted by half the U.S. Fifth Fleet, recaptured a Korean cargo ship that had been commandeered by 13 Somali pirates. To me, this looks like the greatest feat of naval bravery and derring do since the Israeli Defense Forces successfully captured the Mavi Marmara in international waters, killing a mere 9 or so unarmed sailors and relief workers, and saving the starving citizens of occupied Gaza from the unauthorized dumping of tons of humanitarian aid supplies. But the Korean and Israeli exploits were surpassed in bravery by the U.S. Navy a year or so ago. Our Navy freed another cargo ship held by a handful of Somali pirates, capturing the pirates' rubber raft in the process. Afterwards, Glenn Ford produced a fine commentary on our heroism. Ford goes on to address the question, who are the real pirates of Somalia? Hint, it's not the 8 skinny guys in a rubber boat. Let's have a listen.
Let me tell you the story of 100 ships traversing the great big sea, moving the riches of the world in large ships owned by the captains of industry. They were heading to places like Amsterdam, London, and L.A. But they had to change their plans a bit when they were held up on the way. Here's to the pirates of Somalia, sailing the ocean blue. Here's to the pirates of Somalia, I'll raise a jolly Roger to you.
What a weekend for American foreign policy. The United States Navy, backed up by warships from 20 other nations, knocked off 3 Somali guys crouching with rifles in a lifeboat tied by a rope to a U.S. destroyer. To hear the United States corporate media tell it, the Americans had won a huge victory over the forces of evil. The sole surviving Somali was in custody, a 16-year-old who essentially gave himself up earlier after being hurt in a scuffle with the American cargo ship captain, who is now celebrated as a hero of the seven seas and defender of United States national honor. There is something obscene about a superpower whose media and population find great satisfaction and some sick form of national catharsis every time they manage to overcome a weak and desperate opponent. Some dreaded seagoing Somalis began taking up piracy in 1991, when the Somali government disintegrated and there was no one to patrol the country's coasts. About the same time, and not coincidentally, commercial fishing fleets from around the world took advantage of the lack of a Somali coast guard to steal every fish they could find in Somali waters. That's robbery on the high seas, the definition of piracy. An estimated $300 million worth of Somali sea life is pirated by foreigners every year. Other kinds of pirates nowadays often leave something behind, the piratical poisonous waste dumpers. They seem to be mafia-connected outfits that dump radioactive wastes from European hospitals into Somali waters, along with heavy metals and dangerous chemicals of all kinds. A survey by the Somali news agency Wardhear News shows that 70% of Somalis strongly supported piracy as a form of national defense of the country's territorial waters. Having seen their coastal waters pirated by foreigners since 1991, Somalis were then forced to endure the land and air piracy of the Ethiopians and the United States, who collaborated in late 2006 to invade the country and oust the only relatively effective government Somalia had had in 15 years. Occupied by Ethiopia with the backing of the American superpower, Somalis were stripped of the last thing they had on land or sea, their national sovereignty. The foreign super pirates had taken everything. But the Somalis kept fighting back anyway, driving out the Ethiopians and making the Americans fume with rage. The Somalis refused to roll over and die or beg. Black U.S. Congressman Donald Payne's airplane was targeted by mortars when he visited Somalia's ravaged capital, Mogadishu, over the weekend. Payne opposed the U.S.-Ethiopian invasion of Somalia. But some of the Islamist fighters battling for control of the country may not make distinctions among the foreigners who pass through or over their land, and who can blame them? Barack Obama's ambassador to the United Nations, a young black woman named Susan Rice, is positively rabid when it comes to beating Somalia into submission. She was more gung-ho for the U.S.-Ethiopian invasion than George Bush. Susan Rice is no doubt searching for a military solution to Somali piracy, which would amount to more piracy by the same foreigners that have driven Somalis to take such desperate measures. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
Here's to the pirates of Somalia, sailing the ocean blue. Here's to the pirates of Somalia, I'll raise a jolly Roger to you. Harare is a town of fishermen, living lives of hardship and toil. But today they had a really good catch, 2 million barrels of oil. They travel with the pirate's handbook, doing what's just and fair, taxing the robber barons and taking their rightful share. Here's to the pirates of Somalia, sailing the ocean blue. Here's to the pirates of Somalia, I'll raise a jolly Roger to you. Well, there are those who don't like pirates, but I think they're just great. I only wish that I could shake their hands and say, good job, mate. I only wish that I could join them on the seas, keep those tankers at bay, tax the corporations and give the loot away. Here's to the pirates of Somalia, sailing the ocean blue. Here's to the pirates of Somalia, I'll raise a Jolly Roger to you. Here's to the pirates of Somalia, sailing the ocean blue. Here's to the pirates of Somalia, I'll raise a Jolly Roger to you.
That could be none other than David Robix. And I suppose this would be as good a time as any to note that the opinions expressed throughout this program are those of the individual speaker or singer, and do not necessarily represent the views of the presenter, of the station's management or staff, let alone the licensee. Anyway, the moral of the story so far: the fiendish felonies committed against global capitalism by the seagoing pirates of Somalia are several orders of magnitude below the felonies committed against the people of Somalia by the global capitalists and the forces of the United States and its African tool, Ethiopia. But let's move on to psycho killers and other mass murderers. Our show last week had a section on scapegoating, and that touched upon the case of mass murderer James Huberty. He was a working-class white guy. In 1984, he entered his neighborhood McDonald's restaurant in San Diego carrying a rifle. He proceeded to massacre much of the restaurant's largely Hispanic clientele and several innocent pedestrians outside. Let's hear again the news report on Huberty, and then commentary by anthropologist Elliot Layton. This is from the video documentary Human Resources. Layton says, yes, Huberty's acts were deranged. Then he goes on to say, but let's put this in context. Who are the bloodiest mass murderers?
He entered a facility, heavily armed, immediately started shooting everybody.
It was a local man dressed in battle fatigues who declared, I have killed 1,000, I'm going to kill 1,000 more. 41-year-old James Huberty reportedly walked into the restaurant carrying a semi-automatic rifle and two other weapons, enough ammunition to last 2 hours. Witnesses inside said he fired wildly into the unsuspecting crowd gathered for a quick evening meal. He fired through windows, hitting people in the street. He fired at men, women, children, and babies.
There's an interesting perspective that comes out of many studies in psychiatric anthropology, which suggests that mental illness is not just a standardized, invarying thing like diabetes, for example. Diabetes is always the same wherever you are in the world, but mental illness seems to take different forms. Once a person takes leave of reality, once a person abandons the ship of fools, the form that the psychosis takes is often dictated or at least shaped by the dominant culture. Thus, for example, in traditional Ojibwe society, where there was a belief that once a person went insane, this is the Wendigo psychosis, that he or she might eat human flesh. And thus a proportion of people who, feeling that they've left reality, no longer feeling control, begin to act out the particular form of psychosis that their culture is aware of. Multiple murderers tend to differ from conventional single murderers. The ordinary murderer is very uniform everywhere in the industrial world. He's very much a bottom of the working class figure. He's addicted to drugs or alcohol. He has no education or professional qualifications. This is the sort of person who, in a fit of rage, kills a friend or a lover. Multiple murders are a little different. They tend to be more edging towards the middle class in their origins and in their aspirations. And a part of their agenda, of their motivation, is that they devoutly wish to join a higher class but come to feel excluded. In the case of James Huberty, the mass murderer who killed more than a dozen people in that long siege at the McDonald's in San Diego, Huberty used to stare from his apartment across the street at McDonald's, which was filled with Mexican immigrants who were seizing control of this fundamental institution, he thought, of American society, who were able to go there and afford to eat when he couldn't. I tried to argue in a succession of books that these kinds of killers, while their acts are deranged and insane, what they themselves are not necessarily so. Rather, they are alienated individuals who wish to end their life in a way that allows them to release their grudge against society for their perceived exclusions. Multiple killers may be statistically rare, but I've tried to argue that they represent central cultural themes. They embody many of the main ideas in their culture, not only the glorification of violence and manly vengeance, but worldly success and worldly ambition, which they feel they've been foiled in. So they're a prime embodiment of their civilization, not a twisted derangement of it. I've also tried to argue that this fundamentally rebellious rather than revolutionary cast to what they're doing, these ghastly killings they perpetrate, are relatively ignored by government institutions charged with regulating society. They typically pay much more attention to real political dangers and spend much less time and energy and money monitoring this small group of killers. I don't believe personally that the answer to psychopathy is to be found in brain-altering chemicals to change the nature of our society in that artificial way. I think what we ought to start doing is teaching people about the dignity and value and the sacredness of human life and teaching people how to behave towards one another. The important thing to understand, however, is while it's interesting to look into the nature of modern society and see its fissures and fractures and stresses through multiple murderers, it should not be considered that these are the primary killers. Governments and politicians are the main killers. Indeed, some scholars have argued that the state's primary function is as mass murderer, to wage war on other states. And that was how they developed. That's the social impetus for the development of the modern state. So it's kind of disturbing. We don't think of the state in that way, but that's what it is. Hitler and Stalin, between them, killed something like more than 100 million peoples, many of them their own peoples. This small-time, personalized vengeance of a few serial killers and mass killers comes to nothing compared to them. The real killers are governments.
Anthropologist Elliot Layton. In truth, I'd never heard of him before, but I'd like to hear some more. And now for something completely different. I think this show's listeners are the sort of people who read books. I just finished a book. No, it's not my first, but I am enthusiastic about it. So let's have New World Notes' first ever book report. Fanfare, please. For Death of the Liberal Class by Chris Hedges. Okay, with a fanfare like that, this had better be good. Chris Hedges is a journalist and essayist. He grew up in New England and upstate New York. His father was a Presbyterian minister, and from his father, Hedges learned an important lesson. If you take a virtuous, principled stand that is unpopular, don't expect any reward in this world. In fact, expect to be punished. Since we are called upon to pursue virtue, you take the principled stand anyway. His father was fired by more than one white, rural, conservative congregation for his support of the civil rights movement. Likewise, Chris Hedges was fired by the New York Times and booed off the stage while giving a college commencement address. in both cases for arguing that no good will come from the U.S.'s then new wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Hedges describes these two fiascos memorably in his new book, Death of the Liberal Class, published by Nation Books in 2010. Incidentally, after Hedges was heckled and booed at the commencement at Rockford College, and finally removed from the stage by campus security, the local paper gave the story the headline, Speaker Disrupts Graduation Ceremony. And you can read about it in the book. Death of the Liberal Class started out as a critique of the press. As Hedges sees it, the press always serves the ruling elite, but by now it has degenerated into almost nothing but propaganda for the elite interests. Hedges has a good deal of personal experience here, having spent a decade or so abroad as war correspondent for The Times. As with British journalist Robert Fisk, Hedges' experiences covering wars in the Middle East and Yugoslavia inspired a hatred, a loathing of all war. Some unlucky people may be forced to pick up a gun to defend themselves, their families, and their communities from being massacred by invaders. Hedges is not exactly a pacifist. But he stresses that picking up a gun brings out the worst in everybody, the defenders as well as the attackers, the defending Kosovars as well as the invading Bosnian Serbs. Pick up a gun, and next thing you know, it's the convenient scapegoats that are being killed, not the enemy invaders. Hedges saw plenty of this in the former Yugoslavia in the 1990s, and he describes the horrors well in this book. I guess it's obvious to all of us, at least all of us who are listening to this broadcast, that when the people in charge decide to serve their own economic interests by launching a nice little war, anti-war views are almost completely banished from the corporate-controlled press, and banished even more from the other corporate-controlled media. We've seen plenty of this since 2001. After completing his book on the press, Hedges decided that his focus had been too narrow. It's not just the press that has betrayed the American people. All of the so-called liberal institutions that once served as a buffer between the rapacious elite and the average Joe have been destroyed, or muzzled, or have simply sold themselves out to the highest bidder. Hedges' book shows, in turn, how these institutions betrayed the people. The press, the universities, the theater and the other arts, the labor unions, liberal Christianity, and, Judas among Judases, the Democratic Party. In the Great Depression of the 1930s, these institutions put a lot of pressure on government to intervene to help the poor, besieged American people. And Roosevelt and others in government responded to that pressure. Today, these liberal institutions are either doing nothing or else actively aiding the elite in their plunder of the rest of us. I've read three or four of Hedges' books, and this is hands down my favorite. In large part, that's because it is full of fascinating specific details, of concrete particulars. He shows us clearly and concretely what American society was like in the 1920s, 1930s, 40s, 50s. He tells fascinating stories about the government's World War I propaganda machine, the rise of corporate public relations, the Federal Theater Project and other great ideas of the New Deal, the militant labor unions of the old days, how artists and art museums stopped all social criticism, indeed all social relevance, in return for big bucks in grants from the foundations, about the reality of war for the citizens on the ground. Some of this wealth of specifics comes from library research, which Hedges has digested and presented well indeed. Some comes from the media. Some comes from his own observations and experiences as a citizen, a reporter, a war correspondent. Some of my favorite parts come from recent informal interviews Hedges has done. He's picked up the phone and talked with political scientist Sheldon Wallen, Afghani democracy crusader Malalai Joya, Ralph Nader, Noam Chomsky, Norman Finkelstein, Jeremy Scahill, Father Daniel Berrigan, remember him? And virtual reality pioneer Jaron Lanier. These are brilliant, very perceptive people. even the virtual reality guy. And Hedges stands aside and lets them speak. In January, we played a two-part interview with Hedges, and there he talked about various themes from this book. Even if you heard that interview, and especially if you heard it and liked it, I think you'll like the book even more. I found its wealth of details and specific examples very interesting indeed. And these examples touch on practically the entire span of our experience. Art, education, history, politics, books, movies, newspapers, labor, war, religion, betrayal. And by the way, the last chapter is titled Resistance. Chris Hedges' Death of the Liberal Class, published 2010 by Nation Books. On a scale of 1 to 5, I rate this book a 5. I borrowed it, hardbound, from my local public library. I recommend that you borrow the book, buy the book, or, best of all, buy the book for your public library. One last time, Chris Hedges, Death of the Liberal Class, and thanks for listening to The Book Report. Well, on behalf of the entire New World Notes staff, this is Kenneth Doust, Chief Cook and Bottle Washer, thanking you for listening. If you want, you can get a free weekly email newsletter for this show, which will at least warn you what you'll be up against if you tune in again next week. Just send me a request by email. And you'll find my email address, plus pretty pictures, great links, and whatnot, on this show's website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. New World Notes comes to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUHFM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. It'll get to my non-carborundum. Keep giving all you can, and if the spirit moves you, please tune in again next week. Let's go out on a bit of relevant music by Talking Heads. Ciao!